Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Rains Cohen, a member of the club's Environment and Natural Resources Forum, and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience and invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Diana Leaf Christian. Diana is the author of Creating a Life Together, Practical Tools to Grow Eco-Villages and Intentional Communities, and another book, Finding Community, How to Join an Eco-Village or Intentional Community. Editor of Communities Magazine for 14 years, where I met her in that role, she publishes Eco-Villages, a free online publication at ecovillagenews.org. She leads workshops, offers consultation on process and communication issues, with some really good stuff like the one she's doing this weekend in Berkeley, and speaks at conferences internationally. Her articles have appeared in Mother Earth News, Co-Housing Magazine, Permaculture Activist, and Encyclopedia of Community. She's been interviewed by Time Magazine, New York Times, Harper's Magazine, the AARP Magazine, New Dimensions Radio, Peak Moment TV, NPR, and the BBC. Diana writes about consensus and process and communication skills for a Co-Housing Association website. And she lives at Earth Haven Eco Village, a really beautiful spot in North Carolina. Please join me in welcoming Diana, telling us about eco-villages, where they are, what they're doing, and why they're important to us. Diana?
Thanks so much for coming. I have got four more copies of this handout, and more are coming. So would you raise your hand if you'd like one and let Rains give them to you. And then please, if we don't get one to you, we will at the end of the slideshow, because more are coming. Well, let's just jump right in and get started, shall we? My view about what an eco-village is a human settlement where people are interested in living out their sustainability values. That's why they start them. If it's a rural eco-village, they also need to think about economic sustainability. How do we make a living? How do each of us have enough income that we can pay our community dues and fees? How does the community pay its land payments, taxes, and insurance? Economic sustainability. And, of course, whether it's urban, suburban, semi-rural, or rural, we need to know, are we enjoying our life there? Social, cultural, spiritual sustainability. So the way I see it, in a nutshell, when people live in eco-villages, they start them because of their ecological values. They're able to maintain them and continue living there because they've got economic sustainability. And they continue to enjoy them and staying there through time because it feels good, social, cultural, spiritual sustainability. So this is how I slice the pie. Most eco-villages are intentional communities. Most are in the industrialized north. Some are traditional indigenous villages in the global south. Some, north and south, are sustainability education centers where people don't live there full-time year-round, but their small staff is on hand, and people come and learn things. And then there are absolutely new kinds of eco-village projects as well. So intentional community-type eco-villages, the most common kind that we will see in today's slideshow, are people who want to live out their sustainability values, and they want to live in community. They want more of a sense of community. When people live in eco-villages in traditional indigenous villages in parts of Africa, especially various villages in Senegal, in Ladakh, in Sri Lanka, parts of Spain, they've already got community just fine, but they want to get our foot off their neck. Okay, this is one of my heroes, Robert Gilman. He helped create the global eco-village movement in the early 90s, and in the early 90s wrote this book, Eco-Villages and Sustainable Communities, and he created a definition that has been used ever since, a worldwide definition. An eco-village is a human-scale, full-featured settlement in which human activities are harmlessly integrated into the natural world with multiple centers of initiative, in a way that supports healthy human development and which can be successfully continued into the indefinite future. Now, the handout that you have, if you have one, and the one that you'll get if you don't, has this definition in it. So let's take a look at each of the parts of this definition. Human scale means whether there's a few people or a lot of people, you know each other's names, you know each other's faces. When you're having meetings, you can feel the influence that you're having on the outcome of that meeting. You can feel your influence on the decision. You're not a nameless, faceless cog in a wheel. Human scale. Full featured settlement means you live there, you work there, your social life is there, your spiritual life is there, maybe you grow food there, maybe you can buy needed goods and services there. Human activities harmlessly integrated into the natural world means that how you are living, how you're getting around the land, creating your own power, dealing with human waste, what kind of dwellings you live in, are as relatively harmless as you can make them, given the resources you have of skill and labor and time and energy and money. So it's not entirely harmless. Supports healthy human development means that you're not just growing plants, raising food, growing electric power on your solar panels, you're also growing human beings. We're learning how to make decisions cooperatively, share resources, facilitate meetings, work well together in committees. And when we're giving each other feedback, we're learning to be open and honest and self-revealing and able to take it in and say, oh, do I do that? Really? Oops. Okay. Thanks for telling me. Growing people. And when we're having conflict, and notice I'm saying when, not if, because we probably will, being humans, we learn to face it and learn from it and resolve it. And in all that natural building we're doing, we're taking some time off to have fun, play some ultimate frisbee, and hug our friends and stop and smell the vegetables. Supports healthy human development. Multiple centers of initiative, and these are slides of Findhorn in Scotland, means that the intentional community itself that started the whole ball rolling is not the only place that initiates projects, funds, or manages them. Groups of members do, or neighbors do, or groups of members and neighbors can create businesses, nonprofits, consultancies, projects, co-ops, and so on. So at Findhorn, there are many businesses and many co-ops that neighbors and members or neighbors or people who used to live there who now live right by have created multiple centers of initiative. Here at Earth Haven in North Carolina, where I live, the sauna was created by a group of members. The Trading Post General Store was created by one member, and now two others lease it. We get to say at Earth Haven, we've got a sauna. And we get to say, we have a general store, but we, the community, didn't do it. That's multiple centers of initiative. And can successfully be continued into the indefinite future means just what you would think it means. It means that we're teaching our children, and we hope they'll teach their children and their children's children, and we hope they will do it better than we did. Now, I have a question for you. Given that an eco-village is a full-featured settlement, and given that it's harmlessly integrated into the natural landscape, and given that it's successfully continued into the indefinite future, and we haven't gotten to the future yet, are there really any eco-villages in the world? Or is this something of a myth? I would say that this is an affirmation more than a definition, and that very few eco-villages are full-featured. Maybe only three. Maybe Auroville in India, which is very, very large, founded in 1968. Findhorn in Scotland, very, very large and successful, founded in 1964. And Damanhur in India, founded in the early 70s. So I would say that we're going to see aspiring eco-villages in the slideshow, mine included. They're not full-featured yet. They're not harmlessly integrated into the natural landscape. And we haven't gotten into the indefinite future yet, have we? Unless we're getting there by every nanosecond. So why is it that people in eco-villages want to do this? What is their reason? Well, They want to put their values where their lifestyle is. So you believe in these things, you value these things, here is a way to live them. The other thing about eco-villages is their model, their demonstration models for other people to come and learn from, to take classes, to take workshops, to take tours, and to find out what eco-villages are learning. How do eco-villages differ from rural, back-to-the-land communities that you might have seen in the 60s and 70s? The difference is eco-villages want to change the world. They want to be an influence in their part of the world. They want people to come and visit them and see what they're doing and perhaps feel inspired to do the same. They don't want to be not visited and left alone, which is the case with so many rural back-to-the-land homesteading communities. Okay, most eco-villages that I know of utilize permaculture design principles to help them create a very well-designed space. So let's look at what permaculture is. Graham Bell is, I think, either a British or an Australian permaculture teacher. Permaculture is the conscious design and maintenance of agriculturally productive systems which have the diversity, stability, and resilience of natural ecosystems, which means that in permaculture design, what we look for is to see if we can go along with the way nature works instead of going against the way nature works. Further, it's the harmonious integration of the landscape with people providing their own food, energy, shelter, and other material, and non-material needs in a sustainable way. So please keep this in mind as you see some of these eco-village projects today. Okay, let's go look at Findhorn in Scotland, the largest, oldest, perhaps most famous eco-village in the world. Started in 1964 as a spiritual community, and it still is. It's also a holistic education center with more than 52 classes and workshops every year. Two properties. One is the park, which was the original trailer park, which in the UK they call a caravan park, and a Clooney Hill Hotel, which is now Clooney Hill College, several miles away. This is part of their mission and purpose, helping to unfold a new human consciousness and create a positive and sustainable future. So they have spiritual aspirations and ecological ones. In the early 1990s, they started to think about ecological sustainability and began to build passive solar off-grid homes like these. There's about 40 of these now. Findhorn has been a major player in the international eco-village movement, which has been going since the early 90s. The first major conference was there in 95. The second major conference was there 10 years later in 2005. So some of their homes are recycled. These are recycled redwood whiskey barrels. Now, I didn't know that whiskey came in such large barrels. Of course, this is Scotland. Sometimes you have to give your roof a haircut. Four of these, together in their wind generator co-op, provide enough electricity to power all of Findhorn and to sell some back to the local power company. They grow much of their own food on site, not all, but much, and they buy an awful lot of food from local growers right in the region. They're bioregional in terms of their food resource. That's the Phoenix store where they can sell all kinds of things that members make and grow. This is the Living Machine, a biological wastewater treatment plant for gray water. Gray water, which means comes from showers and sinks, comes in one end, passes through thermal siphoning through each of these barrels, passes through the microorganisms on the root hairs of these special aquatic plants that grow in this water and gravel, and passes on out the other end as absolutely potable, drinkable water. This slide here is about their economics, and so I've got somebody holding hay because I didn't have a picture of economics, so I've got making hay. Hope you like that. They have the most developed economy of any eco-village that I know of. $16 million of equivalent in U.S. dollars is created and circulated through northern Scotland just because they're there. And their property's worth $20 million in U.S., and they have created 400 jobs in the area just because they're there. This is how they do creating a village-scale economy. They earn, spend, save, and invest money right on site and in the wider Findhorn Association all around the intentional community. Together, the residents who live in the intentional community, the Findhorn Foundation, and all of the people that live right around them, the Findhorn Association, that's what makes up the eco-village. So they earn money by working for Findhorn itself or for any number of businesses or by owning businesses. Some people are self-employed. Many, many businesses right there. Social enterprises, sacred commerce. This is the stuff of eco-village life. How do you spend money on site? Well, by buying goods and services from each other. For example, in the Phoenix store, and by the way, that currency is called an eco, capital E-K-O, and this is issued by Ecopia Resource Exchange, their on-site credit union. These are interchangeable with British pound sterling and euros, and some of the local Scottish towns take ecos. Over 200 members in the Ecopia Resource Exchange with investment capital of approximately $1,200,000 in U.S. dollars. Homegrown little bank. Why do they earn, spend, invest, and save money right on site? For the same reason that it's a good idea for your blood to circulate in your body, spreading oxygen everywhere. Money is like, in a community or alternative currency, is like a circulatory system with lots of nourishing oxygen. The whole idea is you keep it in the body as long as you can before it goes out somewhere else. So people can invest money in the Phoenix Store Co-op, and of course the Wind Generator Co-op, and the Woodlot Co-op, and the Dairy Co-op, and the CSA Farm Co-op, and people can invest money in each other's businesses. Nobody there is wealthy, and everybody there is an investor. Okay, so the Findhorn Foundation hired the Stockholm Environment Institute back in 2006 to do an ecological footprint study. Now, what that is you take the number of biologically productive acres in the world, and you divide it by the number of people in the world at the current time. Biologically productive acres doesn't mean Antarctica or the desert or the sea. It means places where you can grow food. So how many places like this, acres of biologically productive land, does it take to create everything that we each need? Microphones, little clickers, clothes, computers, digital projectors, rooms, electricity, clocks. And how much does it take to absorb our human waste? Well, if we do that calculation, dividing the world's population in to the number of biologically productive acres, we get 4.5 global acres per person. This, considering the size of the Earth, what acres are productive, how many people we have on the Earth, this is considered our fair share. So how many do you suppose people on the average use up in the UK and in North America? Any guesses? 20? Well, pretty close. In the UK, it's 13.3, and here, 28. So we're using several times our fair share. If everybody in the world used as many globally productive acres as we did, we'd need 8 Earths to provide all those resources. So Findhorn had 6.7 global acres, the lowest ecological footprint ever recorded in the industrialized world. This is partly due to the fact that they have an economy of scale and they share so much. Their homes are very well heated, very efficient in their heating, and they don't have to travel a lot of distance to go to work. They just walk or take the bike, so right there. They grow a lot of their own food. So 21.5% of the British average for heating and 37% of the British average for food. And that's Findhorn in northern Scotland. So now I'd like to show you a much newer community that's much more primitive and rustic and in the early stages. It's my hometown, Earthhaven Eco Village, in the Blue Ridge Mountains of North Carolina, not so far from Asheville. 320 acres, 16 springs, 7 streams. This is our mission and purpose, to care for people in the earth and to create and to sustain beyond our lifetimes a learning community village. It's an independent income community. There's two kinds of communities, income sharing. These are often called communes. Very, very few in North America, but the ones that do exist are large and big and old and famous, like Twin Oaks in Virginia. And independent income communities, where you don't work for a community business, but rather you buy in, you have your own source of income, you keep that source of income yourself. In an income sharing community, you work for the community, one or more of its businesses, and you receive room and board and a stipend, or room and board plus your basic wants and needs are met by the community. So Earth Haven, like most you will see in the slideshow, is an independent income community. Costs $4,000 one-time non-refundable joining fee per adult. And for a site lease fee, $12,000 or $20,000, it's a one-time fee, 99-year renewable transferable lease. I'm just telling you these details about Earth Haven so you can get a sense of one way that groups do it, but they do it all different ways. So there's 13 neighborhoods at Earth Haven. Not all of them have the land cleared and houses there, maybe only about 10 so far. All the houses are passive solar. Everything is built without bank loans. It's either money that people have on hand or it's some money borrowed from friends with personal loans with friendly terms. Why is this? Two reasons. One, we are so cool. And the second is we couldn't possibly get bank loans if we tried because there's nothing to foreclose on. We all own all the land. Okay, two kinds of buildings at Earth Haven, natural buildings and hybrid buildings. And the natural buildings are made of all these earthen materials. And as you can see, they do have an effect on your wardrobe. These are some of the natural buildings at Earth Haven. The top one is our 13-sided round pole timber-framed council hall where we hold meetings. Hybrid buildings are a combination of conventional construction techniques and conventional materials with natural materials and techniques. There are friendly competitions at Earth Haven between which buildings are better. The natural building aficionados say, but these buildings are beautiful and they're curved and they look so wonderful and they feel so good. And the people who advocate the hybrid building say, our buildings take less time to build, are cheaper to build, are warmer in the winter, cooler in the summer, and they don't have mildew. So there. Okay, here are some. This is a slide to show you that we're off the grid, 100% off the grid. Almost every house and or neighborhood has solar panels on the roof or in the yard, and we have microhydro, that's the lower photo there, in the center of the village. Water comes from two wells, six springs, and roof water catchment on almost every house, either with plastic tanks or homemade ferro cement tanks. We keep food cold with refrigerators made for off-grid power, which means thick insulation and low electrical loads relatively compared to regular refrigerators, or picnic coolers with an ice jug in the back, put in the back of the yard where the sun never shines on the north side of the house. Or we keep some food cool in root cellars, or we ferment food. See, that's what that fellow has that look on his face. He's eating sauerkraut. Gray water is recycled through constructed wetlands like the one you see on the right, or gray water boxes where either wood chips, in the case of the left, the wood chips have the microorganisms that transform the soapy water, and on the right, the same situation that you saw at Findhorn. We have two kinds of composting toilets, indoor and out. As you can see, we're a highly spiritual community, but this will be meaningful only if you're only over 50. We won't tell them who Ram Dass is, okay? Okay, how do we get around the land and how do we get to town? Bicycling and walking around the land and our favorite transportation is a few folks have solar-powered golf carts. That's a solar panel on the roof, keeps the rain off, plus gets you around. We carpool to town. Some people drive individual cars. I'm ashamed to say some of us drive one car with one person in it using a regular gas all the way to Asheville and back. And we're going to have a biodiesel fueling station on site soon. We have classes and workshops and tours. And we make decisions by consensus, twice monthly business meetings. 11 different committees do most of the task work. How do we make a living on the land? Remember economic sustainability. Well, it's very similar to Findhorn. We own various people own businesses. Some people work for other members. Some telecommute. Very, very few work off-site. What are the kinds of goods and services that people do that other people hire? We always, always hire each other when we need something. And if we can't hire one of us, we hire one of our immediate neighbors. And if we can't hire one of our immediate neighbors, we hire a farther away neighbor. The whole point is bioregional local economics. So one of the businesses is Red Moon Herbs, a woman-owned, women-run business making herbal products for women. Useful Plants Nursery is growing organic fruit and berry bushes, fruit trees and berry bushes, from pots organically, which is rare in the nursery business, with customers all over the eastern U.S. And Road Warrior Construction making off-grid homes with off-grid power. It's really hard to make a home with off-grid power when the home doesn't have a roof yet to put the panels on. So what they do is they get electricity by having a truck with rotating tilt-up panels that they can tilt toward the sun no matter where the sun is relative to their construction site, so they face them to the south. And when it's not sunny, such as a week of rain, they idle the motor. They have a large alternator under the hood which uses biodiesel fuel to create enough electricity either from the panels or the alternator goes into the batteries in the back of the truck. They have every power tool known to man or beast in that truck. And rain or shine, day or night, they could build a house running four power tools at once. The Forest Children's Co-op is a homeschool program, a homeschool enrichment program, created by Earth Haven members and neighbors. So it's not just something that Earth Haven did, it's by individuals and also our neighbors, just like we saw at Findhorn, another example of multiple centers of initiatives. So are we vegetarians at Earth Haven? Some people are surprised to see we're not. Our agreement is to have dietary freedom so people choose the diet they want, though we encourage everyone to buy from local growers and farmers. Most people have home gardens. Neighborhood have home gardens. Two fellows leased some agricultural land at Earth Haven and created a trout pond so they can eat trout and sell them to us. This is Imani Farm. It's a lease of a half-acre parcel where they raise cows for dairy, and they raise chickens and pigs and ducks, chicken meat, eggs. Yellow Root Farm is a biodynamic market garden. They sell plant starts and produce and pork and chicken meat and eggs. They sell to us and to local farmers markets. And Gateway Farm, a 4.5-acre farm, which is the largest farm and the largest possible farm in our mountainous territory. 4.5 relatively flat acres is rare there, so this is the big farm. If any of you are from farming families, you know that farms are usually hundreds of acres, so this is basically a postage stamp. They're using the Wazan rotational grazing method where you take an ungulate like a cow or sheep or goats. They're using Icelandic sheep. You put them in a movable pen and rotate them every few days around your pasture, followed by flocks of some kind of livestock bird, in their case, turkeys, heirloom breed turkeys, and chickens, which results in restoring the soil because of all that free nitrogen and results in all kind of protein for the flocks because the flies lay their eggs for free in the sheep poop, which hatches into maggots for free, which probably wouldn't make a delicious lunch for you and me, but turkeys and chickens love it. So chickens and turkeys need 40% protein. This is a very effective, efficient method of farming. These fellows run Gateway. They run Road Warrior Construction. So by day, they're building houses with off-grid power, and mornings, evenings, and weekends, they're tending to their animals. Someday they will be doing a market garden, a vegetable seed-saving business with organic seeds. They have a fish pond. They'll be selling sunfish and bass. And they'll be making ethanol fuel and all kinds of other products, food, fuel, lumber, electricity. And most of all, what they'll be making is jobs for other Earth Haven members. So you're starting to see how this all fits together. Permaculture principles. Oops. Looks like I was going backwards. Let me just back up a sec here. Okay, so some people think that we might be kind of unusual, but what we like to say is, oh, heck no, we're not. We're just trying to do something amazing. Okay, let's go look at Ecovillage at Ithaca. Findhorn is large and old and famous, started out as a spiritual community. Earth Haven is started out as an ecovillage right from the get-go, but it's small and young and kind of rustic and primitive. Ecovillage at Ithaca is two, going on three, clustered co-housing communities with architects and bank loans and contractors and completely built-up buildings, and it's so lovely that you could take your grandmother there and she'd be perfectly at home. This is the first neighborhood, 30 passive solar homes. It's called FROG, First Residents Organized Group. As in most co-housing communities, they have a common house where they have optional shared meals 3 nights a week. And, of course, they have a laundry room, a children's room. This is where they get their mail, a teenage hangout room, 8 offices so that people can work on site, which, of course, reduces their ecological footprint. They hold their meetings there. And this is SONG, Second Organized Neighborhood Group. These homes, unlike at the first neighborhood, many of them are off the grid. These are passive solar homes also, 30 homes. They have their own common house. Right now, the folks at Ecovillage at Ithaca are building their third cluster of, clustered right near to them, 30 homes. And that one is called TREE, Third Residence Ecological Enterprise. So there have been 2 studies, one by MIT, one by Cornell University, and they found that the folks at Ecovillage at Ithaca use energy about 40% lower than the national average in the U.S. The buildings are tight and efficient, and that's how they planned it from the get-go. So they have 2 CSA farms on site. One is called West Haven Farm, 10 acres, runs for 7 months a year. 1,000 shareholders get fresh organic produce from West Haven Farm, from the distribution center. Most of the people at Ecovillage at Ithaca are shareholders, plus a lot of neighbors all around them. I hope you're starting to see that in ecovillages, there's quite a lot of influence and mutual benefit with neighbors. They have a second CSA farm, a U-Picket organic berry farm, where you can get all kinds of berries and strawberries and grapes. This is a picture of Strausheim, Germany, an aerial photo of a little town. And just notice how there is densely packed city and then whammo, farms, right smack outside the edge of the city. No suburbs, no long commutes for the farmers. They just bring their produce into the market, and people in this town are quite assured that there's plenty of food growing locally. Well, I hope you're starting to get the sense that that's what Findhorn's attempting to do, that's what Earth Haven is slowly starting to do, and that's what the folks at Ecovillage at Ithaca are doing. Put food right here, right now. They get around the land and also get to town by buses, public transportation. They lobbied the local bus company to have a stop right outside their gate, and they do. And they also are members of the Ithaca City Carpool Co-op, where there are 6 cars, and one of them is permanently parked there. Of course, they have fun. Remember social, cultural, spiritual sustainability. Here they are in a work party building the bridge between the first 2 neighborhoods. Ecovillagers got to have fun. This is a very, very important annual event at Ecovillage at Ithaca. Guys baking pies. And that's Ecovillage at Ithaca, the beautiful co-housing community comprised of 2 and pretty soon 3 co-housing communities. Let's go across to the other side of the world, to Oroville, which, like Findhorn, is a large, old, famous spiritual community which later became an eco-village. So really huge, 2150 acres, 1,800 residents, 100 different little neighborhoods. This is the founders of Auroville arriving in 1968 to this barren, hot desert. Hot winds blowing across this dusty plain, monsoon rains creating erosion in the Grand Canyon there. In the 1700s, this was a lush, thick, humid jungle with tigers and elephants. The British said, "We need to cut down these trees to create ships for the British Navy. We need to cut down these trees to create bungalows for ourselves to live in. We need to cut down these trees to build the town of Pondicherry, India. And we need to cut down these trees to create cooking fuel." And they did, and this is what we get. So what do you do when you're starting a spiritual community in 1968, and you're filled with vision and energy, and you're going to live on a desert like this? Well, there's only one thing to do. Get naked and plant trees. Now, as you can see, this fellow is not really naked. He is wearing a hat. So people who joined Auroville in those days became tree planters, watering each tree by hand day after day with little pots of water, hand-carried. They didn't have any sprinkler system. They sure didn't have long hoses or a good source. They had to go get it out of the gullies and hand it up through many, many people in a bucket brigade to keep these trees alive. They also built swales, which is these mounded up rims of earth, which they built on the contour so that the water coming down would sink into the earth before it ran down to the Bay of Bengal. Day after day, week after week, year after year, they planted trees on the barren desert at Auroville. How many trees do you suppose they have planted from 1968 till now? What did you say? 2 million? Well, usually people start off at 10,000. You saw the video. Well, it's either 2 million or three. Yes. That's right. It's Auroville in India. The name of the community is Auroville. That's right. It's named after Sri Aurobindo, and Auro means dawn, dawn city. Okay, yeah. So somebody recently told me it's 3 million. I don't know. I'll have to find out. They've changed the climate in this part of India. It's now cooler and more moist. This is what it looks like now. No tigers or elephants yet. From this to this. And this is typical of what eco-villages do. They restore their part of the world. They restore the earth. They are earth restorers. At Earth Haven, we have crummy soil from years and years of unsustainable farming practices by Scots-Irish Appalachian farmers. We're restoring the soil. Dancing Rabbit Eco-Village in Missouri, they're restoring the tall grass prairie. Are they still planting trees at Auroville? You bet. Okay, so let's take a look at what they're doing there. This spiral nebula-looking rendering is a drawing of how they had imagined they would create the community. They don't own all of the land in a contiguous parcel. They own little parcels, and there are villages of Tamil Indian people living in between the parcels. They wanted it to have four swirling out from the center of a galaxy-like shapes of four different kinds of places there: residential, industrial, cultural, and international pavilions surrounded by a green belt. Auroville was founded by a woman named Mira Alfasa, a French woman who was a spiritual teacher living in India. She was a colleague of Sri Aurobindo, an Indian spiritual teacher. He asked her to start a community, and she did, based on the idea of human unity. Can people from all over the world get along together with each other? Can we all live here from all these different cultures? And so that is the experiment, the ongoing experiment at Auroville. The most numerous of people represented there, one-third of their population, are from all over India. The next most numerous, of course, are French people, because the teacher, the mother, Mira Alfasa, was French. And then comes the UK and Italy and the Netherlands and Germany, North America, and some other Asian countries. The round golden temple is called the Matra Mandir, which means Mother Temple. It's created with gold and ceramic plates, Where did that money come from? From donations, mostly from Europe. Thousands of people visit every year. This is the solar kitchen. See the big solar collector on the roof? Hundreds of mirrors focusing the sunlight onto a barrel that contains water, which then heats up to steam. With that steam heat, they're able to cook 2,000 lunches a day. And these ladies in the corner here are putting the lunch into stainless steel Indian lunch pails to take them out to the Tamil villagers. At Oroville, there is such a thing as a free lunch. Okay, back to the U.S. of A. I wanted to show you an urban eco-village. This is one of my favorites, Los Angeles Eco-Village, in the heart of downtown Los Angeles, in a working-class neighborhood 3 miles from downtown L.A., with immigrants from Korea and Hispanic countries. Two apartment buildings, and here they are, right next to each other, with 40 intentional neighbors, people who rent in the buildings. Other people rent in the buildings who were there before they got started, and they take part in the social life, but they're not actively part of the governance in the community by their own choice. So they're bicycle activists, they're public transportation activists. Many of them ride bikes for a living as bicycle messengers. They all are really very much getting around LA on bikes, and they do bike repair workshops. $20 off on your rent if you don't own a car. In their large courtyard, they have parties and dances and potlucks and social events and musical events and gardening work parties and permaculture classes like you see up at the top. Into that courtyard, they bring mulch and soil amendments and fruit trees and vegetables, and sometimes they raise chickens or ducks or rabbits. Certainly not enough food to live on, but enough gardening to make people in the middle of a big city feel connected to the earth. They get their food from a food co-op with a drop-off distribution point in the courtyard, in the lobby of the bigger building. Neighbors from all over the neighborhood, not just these 40 people, come and get their food here. They have meetings and parties and potlucks and musical events in the large lobby of the larger apartment. They're very much social justice activists, environmental activists. They do a lot of things out on the street. They lobbied and got their street outside of them to be a slow street, so cars have to slow down because there's speed bumps and little benches and such. This is Lois Arkin, who is the founder of LA Eco Village. Here she is at a fake groundbreaking ceremony with a cardboard box on top of a red carpet with some sand in it and some gold-plated shovels with a bunch of officials from L.A. As you can see, she is now considered cool enough to get invited to fake groundbreaking ceremonies. But when she started out back in the early 90s, she was considered that kooky lady from downtown L.A. who talked about weird things like composting and recycling. But now she's the darling of the city council and the mayor. Film crews come to film Lois and L.A. Eco Village. L.A. Eco Village is in the L.A. Times at least once a year. These people below are on a tour to the U.S. from China. They had to stop off at L.A. Eco Village and see it. So there we have L.A. Eco Village, the best of the city and the country. Okay, I want to show you very, very briefly other places around the world that are eco-village projects so that you can get a sense of just how international it is. There are many more eco-village projects in North America than I've shown you here, but this is the shorter version of a slideshow given our time frame today. Eco-village Siebenlinden in the former East Germany. The folks are straw bale builders and activists. That's the largest straw bale building in Europe. They teach straw bale, advocate straw bale. And one of their neighborhoods, like Earth Haven, they have many different neighborhoods. One of them, called Club 99, has as their goal to be vegans, to be income sharing, to not use electricity at all. So they built this house with hand tools and saved 95% of the usual amount of carbon dioxide emissions that you would create in building a building. They also garden with draft horses instead of with rototillers or other kinds of electric tools. As you can see in the lower left, the Kindergarten in the Woods. This is a homeschool co-op made of members, parents and neighboring parents, just exactly like Earth Haven. They have cottage industries on the land, including they put out the book Eurotopia, which is the European version of the community's directory. 2001-2002, the University of Kassel in Germany decided to do a study to see just how ecological two eco-villages were, one Siebenlinden and one Kommune Niederkaufungen, and they wanted to see how they compared to the average German household in terms of creating, transporting, and using these common household resources. So Kommune Niederkaufungen used up only 42%, emitted only 42% of carbon dioxide compared to the average German household. Siebenlinden was even less, 28%. And Siebenlinden was particularly good on home heating and housing because they have large, well-insulated, highly efficient, well-heated houses. And they don't spend a lot of money on houses and a lot of resources because they're using straw. Lebensgarten in Germany, founded a long time ago, 1984, on the former barracks where workers in World War II made bullets and bombs. So this is a barracks of munitions workers. So when these ecological activists bought this place, they said, what can we do to change the vibes here? And they decided to make it beautiful, put beautiful glass greenhouses on, and dance in the plaza before breakfast in the morning. Svanholm in Denmark is very large, 998 acres, founded in the late 1970s. A lot of members, 140, they all live in this great big mansion. You can see the front of the mansion there. They are dairy farmers, organic dairy farmers, and organic growers, and they introduced organic produce and organically raised milk to the health food stores and the supermarkets in Denmark back in the 70s. They have a wind generator, and what you see, that bright green, strange-looking device in the lower right is a Stirling engine, which creates electricity and heat through most unusual means, not the internal combustion engine. So they're doing what they can to be having a low ecological footprint. That's Svanholm in Denmark. And here's Munksgaard in Denmark. Five clustered co-housing communities, not three like Ecovillage at Ithaca, but five. This billboard shows the original Danish farmhouse, clusters of five different co-housing communities with different colored buildings all around it, 20 units in each cluster. One is plain old regular co-housing. You buy it, you make your payments. The next one is affordable housing. The Danish government gives you a discount on your down payment. The next three are rental units. One rental units for anybody and everybody. One rental units for older folks. That's the photo you see there. And the third one, rental units for families with young children. They wanted to make it affordable to every income level in Denmark. They got an award in year 2000 for the most sustainable design for the 21st century in Denmark. So here is the oldest eco-village in the world, some say. Founded in 1930 in Iceland by a woman who was a student of Rudolf Steiner. So the people here are taking care of and working with people with developmental disabilities. They're using the curative education program of Rudolf Steiner. This is not a Camp Hill community, which also does that. This is its own thing. Very large, very old. Because it's Iceland, they get their heat from the ground, geothermal energy. First, the heat goes into their buildings and heats their buildings, but there's heat left over. So they send it on to their greenhouses where they grow their food. And by the way, let me back up a sec. And then there's still heat left over. So they send it underneath their sidewalks to heat the sidewalks so they don't have to shovel snow through their long, long, long fall, winter, and spring. I don't know how long their summers are. I'm guessing maybe 2 days or three. And they go outside and have fun and do cartwheels, as you can see. But they spend much of their year inside their large, beautiful greenhouses. And that's Solheimer in Iceland, perhaps the oldest eco-village in the world. Here's Kater's Children's Village in Russia. The land was given to the people who started this for free after the collapse of the collective farming system. What they do there is raise orphans with foster families. Their whole point is the orphanage system in Russia is really bad. Let's help children have loving families to raise them, love them, nurture them, and educate them. so that we can raise the next generation of Russians with some hope and some kindness. Torre Superiore in southern Italy is a group of permaculture teachers who in 1989 bought this medieval ruin, started in the 1300s, continuously occupied until the end of World War II, when people left to go to the cities to get jobs, and it fell into ruin. And these folks said, let's restore it stone by stone. It's three stories, eight levels, 160 rooms, and that's just what they're doing. And now it's a bed and breakfast. It's an ecotourism resort destination. They teach permaculture classes there. You can go and have fabulous organic food grown on these terraces that they're restoring. And that's Torre Superiore in southern Italy. Here is Jonathan Dawson, author of my favorite book about ecovillages, former president of Global Ecovillage Network. Yogurt culture, small, dense, and rich concentrations of activity whose main aim is to transform the nature of that which surrounds them. Now you know what we ecovillages are doing. We're inoculating the wider milk. So let's keep going around the world, see a few more. This is Tlalejo Educational Center and Ecovillage in South Africa, founded in the early 90s. It is a sustainability education center rather than that everybody, it's not an intentional community. It was founded with the idea that we will help folks in this part of Northwest South Africa learn organic gardening and sustainable farming and how to create their own homes with natural building methods. We'll use the traditional sauna building, which has thatched roofs and natural plasters, and we'll just learn all of these things. And oh, here's the composting toilet. Please notice the sculpture on the composting toilet, which tells us what the building is for. So they would have classes and workshops, and folks would come and create little models of these buildings on the ground and learn how to do cob walls and learn how to do plastering. But the folks who were coming to the classes said, you know, we really don't want traditional sauna buildings. We want rectangular buildings like you live in. So to their credit, the people at Tlalejo said, okay, we'll create a building system for you that's cheap, passive solar, you can do it yourself, small homes that you can make with mud bricks that you can make yourself in your yard. Those gents that you saw have made 10,000 mud bricks. They've become experts at it. The little stairways leading up are to the composting toilet part of these homes, which is similar to those at Earth Haven. El Pancho Eco Center in Bolivia, similarly, is an educational center, teaching permaculture, natural building, how to start new eco-villages. IPEC in Brazil, same thing. Restoring the land right there, teaching permaculture, appropriate technology, off-grid power of the photovoltaic and the wind generator kind, but mostly they're teaching natural building. People come from all over Brazil and South America to learn from them. They're very much into art and beauty. They're Brazilian. So they've got a little lesson on how you use a water catchment tank painted on the side of water catchment tank. The medium is the message. And here's Huehue Coyotl, which means very, very old coyote, in central Mexico, a group of street theater people, musicians, puppeteers, actors, dancers, traveled all over Europe and Mexico in bus caravans in the 1980s, decided to land in 1989 on this land in central Mexico. And because they're into art, they made it beautiful. Again, they teach courses in permaculture and all the... do you mean shut the slideshow down right now? There's just a few more slides, Rains. Okay, so this is Crystal Waters in Australia. Very famous because it was one of the earliest eco-villages that was publicized worldwide as an eco-village. The land was damaged from too much overgrazing and clear-cutting, but they're restoring it. They're restoring not only the tropical rainforest in their gullies and valleys, but they're doing their best to make the water as crystal clear, Crystal Waters, as they can. People live in passive solar homes. Some are off the grid, not all. They all use roof water catchment. They lobbied the local county to allow cottage industries on site, and now, just as at Earth Haven, just as at Findhorn, just as at Auroville, people make a living right on site. And now the economic development of the area is considerably improved just because they're there. My favorite community, along with my own, is Konohana Family Farm in Japan. It's a spiritual community founded in order to grow lots of food and be having a nutritious diet. See Mount Fuji right there above their field? And also to share every evening after dinner their emotions, what they thought about that day, what they felt, what went on with them. So they're having nourishment coming in and the nourishment of each other emotionally. They grow 260 different kinds of produce here. They're vegetarians. They grow several kinds of rice, soybeans, millet, wheat, barley, fruits and vegetables, goats and chickens. They make traditional Japanese foods in the traditional Japanese way, and they sell these foods all over Japan. They sell a microorganism called effective microorganism, EM, to farmers all over the world, organic growers, and they're cultivating happiness and teaching others what they're learning. This is the Japanese Eco Village Conference in 2002. I'm gonna show off here. That's me. I got to be a speaker at that conference. So why do so many people go to so much trouble? Here's Hilda Jackson. She's one of the founders of the Global Eco Village movement. The desire to take responsibility for one's own life, to create a future which we would like to bequeath to our children so they, and in turn their children, may grow up as balanced and healthy human beings. Well, this is why we're doing it. This is the reason we're going to all this trouble. This is why we take such pains to do all of this that you've seen today. It's so that these people can learn what we're learning. It's so that folks like gentlemen in the white shirt can pass on what they're learning to folks like gentlemen in the green shirt. It's for the future. It's for them. And that's the slideshow. Thank you so much.
Our thanks to Diana Leaf Christian, EcoVillage News Publisher, for her comments here today. I'm Rains Cohen, a member of the Commonwealth Club's Environment and Natural Resources Forum, and I'll kick off today's question and answer period for Diana with a question. We just came from the National Co-Housing Conference, and there Jan Goodman-Hoyer, a movement founder, spoke of co-housing as a feminist form of development. Can you comment about gender roles in eco-villages and how shifts may be happening?
Did you see the ladies with chainsaws? I think there's shifts happening relative to gender roles, but I'm so used to it that I haven't stopped to think about it. People do the jobs and roles that they like to do and that seem needed and that the other folks seem like, yep, that's a good idea. And it's such a big non-issue that I can hardly answer the question. Women just do different things. Sometimes they're builders covered with mud. I'd like to know how much time we have for questions, because I've got a question here that was given to me originally. Is there time for any more?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, this is a question that says, I own a fourplex. I'm a landlord in Oakland. First question, how does one get around rent control in terms of if a member does not maintain the vision of the community and if the group does not get along and wishes that member to move out? It's possible to do community with a rental unit situation where somebody is the landlord and others are tenants. But it's very, very important to have a set of rights and responsibilities that you have as a tenant and rights and responsibilities that you don't have and rights and responsibilities that the landlord has and rights and responsibilities that the landlord doesn't have. And then everybody has a copy of everybody's yes and no rights and responsibilities. Maybe decisions are made about property value only by the landlord, and decisions about everything else by all the folks together. But it's a tricky situation, and I don't think it usually works to have a landlord say, hey, I want to create community here. The best I think we can get is a community-like atmosphere if there's a common area for folks to hang out in or have common meals in or do rotating potlucks. Because tenants are protected by landlord-tenant law, If the group doesn't like X or Y person who lives in Unit 3B, they can't do anything. That person gets to stay living there. The only thing that I could suggest is that the tenants themselves join an association of tenants that is a membership organization. They've still got all their rights to live in that apartment, but there's a second organization that is created by the folks who want to do community, and they do community together. And anybody who doesn't want to or who doesn't feel inclined to, such as at LA Eco Village, simply doesn't participate, but it doesn't mean they don't say hi when they see you in the hall. Second question, how do you advertise engage renters without infringing on fair housing laws? You can't. You have to follow fair housing laws. But if you have the second organization, they can join it. Other questions?
I see hands. Other questions out there?
Most of the pictures of the people that you showed were engaged in income-generating activity. How do you decide the percentage of people who will work in services for the community, and who does, say, 15 people out of 40 want to be cooks? How are those kinds of decisions made?
Your question implies that you're talking about an income-sharing community where, yes, because in a non-income-sharing community, an independent income community, that question doesn't work.
Are there not any common grounds or things that need to be taken care of even in a community such as your own?
Okay, now I understand your question. Sorry. Well, sure, people apply for either they do it as volunteers as part of their committee work because communities have labor credit and you have labor requirements and you do labor for the community and you choose what kind of labor you're going to do or you choose it together with others, or the community might have money to pay people for small part-time jobs, and then you just apply for the job and you get it or you don't. Hope that helps. Any other questions? I saw another hand over here.
I don't know if I need that either. So I was wondering if you could say something about diversity at the communities as far as racial and cultural diversity, and if there are certain communities that kind of really put an emphasis on that.
Auroville, Los Angeles Eco Village. I don't know of any others that do. Almost every community I know is filled with middle-class, well-educated white people, except for those which are in other countries. You know, so I'm talking about Western Europe and North America and Australia and New Zealand. All of them would love to have people from other cultures join them, but they don't seem to attract them. Now, that might be because people of other cultures would prefer not to do that, would prefer to just say, hey, now that I've moved to this country, now that I'm an immigrant in this country, I kind of like my own folks, and I want to get my house and my three-bedroom house and my two cars, et cetera, et cetera. While some people are downsizing, other people might be saying, hey, that's why I moved to this country, so I can have this stuff that I've been seeing in movies that these Western folks have. Or maybe they've been there for centuries also, but they say, you know, I don't really like those white, middle-class, well-educated people so much. I'd rather live for my own kind. So it's an ongoing, interesting issue. Any other questions?
Have you found any, what is the human scale carrying capacity, and have you seen any, limitations with scaling this concept, and are within some of the eco-villages, there's been, multiple communities? Are those the
multiple
human scale?
Multiple neighborhoods,
sorry. Mm-hmm. Are those the human scale units? How does the human scale unit, how does that grow, and what are the learnings there?
Thanks. At Earth Haven, the little neighborhoods were based on how many passive solar off-grid home sites could be on gentle south-facing slopes and gentle north-facing slopes. And so there are 13 neighborhoods that range between 3 and 8 home sites. At Zeeben Linden, where they have flat land and it's not such an issue, I don't know what their thoughts are about neighborhood size. I think it's just cohesive groups of friends who want to be with each other. The whole community is considered human scale, not neighborhoods, but all the neighborhoods together. Auroville, Zeeben Linden, and Earth Haven have different neighborhoods. Dancing Rabbit, which you didn't see, has different sub-communities. some income sharing, some not. Some people say, well, so what's a village scale? And some people who study villages say, well, between 500 and 1,000 people. You can know everybody if it's 500 people. And some say if you are related to everybody, like in a traditional indigenous village, and you know who's your aunt's, cousin's, sister's, husband's, in-law, you can remember 1,000 people because you've got a matrix for it, the family system. I think that those eco-villages that utilize permaculture design are thinking carrying capacity, and it'll depend on the site, the land, the topography, the resources there. I wish I could answer you more fully, but that's about the most I know.
Dinah, can you say anything about the biggest challenges of living in community?
Oh, well, it's not solar panels and greenhouses. It would be us. Just as you might have expected, that human species can make each other nuts. And that's why there are wonderful processes and self-governance techniques and so on. And this is what I try to share in the workshops that I do and in my book about how to start communities. This is very important. It's as important as any off-grid power. How do we help each other encourage ourselves to get along in a win-win way, which is completely different than what our culture's been teaching us our whole lives?
What future do you see for urban co-housing? Particularly, I believe that Oakland has something going on. I don't know of any other. There are some, like for spiritual, Ananda and so forth, but I'm thinking just where the commonality is a desire to live together in a middle-class type of facility.
Urban is where it's at. Urban is what's needed. So let me tell you that there's lots of urban eco-villages. We just didn't have enough time for me to show you lots of them. Cleveland Eco-Village, sponsored by the City of Cleveland, a redeveloped neighborhood with lots of green developers, churches, community groups, environmentalists, redevelopment agencies, the local Rapid Transit Authority getting together to create an urban neighborhood eco-village. Enright Ridge Eco-Village in Cincinnati, not only Los Angeles Eco-Village, but other projects in other cities. This is where it's at.
Just a quickie. I wonder, in terms of the cross-section of age, we saw children and middle-aged people, but is there a place in this kind of a system for elderly, especially as they become less able to do some of the work and so on?
Yes. Oh, for God's sake. I'm trying to fix it so you don't have to look at my sloppy desktop. Sorry about that. Rains can answer that question because he is an advisor to folks who are looking for senior co-housing. There are no eco-villages that I know of that are about older folks, although every eco-village that I know of is interested in having older folks. And my mother, who's 93, you saw her in the slideshow demonstrating the composting toilet with pouring sawdust in. That's her moment of fame. She may be the eldest eco-villager in the world. However, Betsy over here and Rains are involved in an organization that helps people in co-housing find and build senior co-housing. So maybe you could say something about that. Okay.
I see the term transition town on your sheet. Could you define that and say how it differs from an eco-village?
I sure can. I'm sorry that I don't have that in the slideshow. I have it in my usual slideshow, but this is a short time frame here at the Commonwealth Club, so I took it out. A permaculture teacher named Rob Hopkins was teaching permaculture at a junior college in Kinsale, Ireland, and said, folks, let's not just take on a normal design project for this semester. Let's take on peak oil, and let's design something that neighborhoods and towns and villages and small areas can do to make themselves deal well with energy descent, with the rising of prices and the lowering of availability of oil and all the things that come from it. They created a plan called the Kinsale Energy Descent Plan, which was their student project. The town of Kinsale adopted it. And from that, Rob Hopkins went back, got his PhD, moved back to the UK where he lives, and moved to a town called Totnes in southern England and began to share what he had learned about peak oil, climate change, the potential of global economic instability. This was before the crash. And said to the folks, here's folks that I can bring in to speak. Here's movies we can watch and films. What might we do in response to this, ahead of the curve, to create the kind of town that we'd want to live in anyway? How can we create local energy, local food, local economy. And they did it, and they did it so beautifully with community gardens and planting even more walnut trees. It's the Walnut Center of England. Creating local currency, really getting into what kind of place do they want, based not on being guilt-tripped or horrified or overwhelmed, but saying, what do we want? How can we create vision and hope and go along with the human nature desire to share and contribute and create something beautiful? And they did. Then the next town over wanted to do it, then other towns in England, and now there's dozens of towns in the UK and dozens of projects in North America and many more projects worldwide. It's maybe the fastest growing social and ecological movement the world has ever seen. Doing it local, getting ready ahead of the time for when we want to have local currency, local food, local energy. It's not just towns anymore. It's neighborhoods and cities, peninsulas, islands, small regions. The transition movement, if you Google it, you'll be astonished at what you'll find.
What's the difference between this and multi-use developments in urban areas? And I wonder how the eco-village community, how they supported the city in getting involved, the city that you mentioned before, involved in doing that kind of project within this city.
I'll answer the second part first. It was initiated by Cleveland, not by grassroots folks. Usually these are grassroots efforts, but in that particular instance, it was the city that initiated it for one of its neighborhoods. In the case of Enright Ridge Eco Village in Cincinnati, it's a group of people that live along a cul-de-sac with a big woods all around. They created a trail around their backyard so that they can all go to each other's house through the woods, and there's hardly any traffic because it's a cul-de-sac. And they've been creating all kinds of sustainability features and neighborhood potluck dinners and childcare co-ops and so on. So it's a grassroots effort. The city of Cincinnati doesn't necessarily know or care what they're doing because they're not changing anything. They're just living in their individually owned units. The first thing you said is, how does it differ from a multi-use development? Well, in all the ways that you saw, in a multi-use development, I guess a development company owns the land and sells the units to both shopkeepers and people that live in houses. And in eco-villages, a bunch of people get together and create their own community their own way. I thought that it was pretty obvious in the slides that it wasn't like a developer doing it. Is that clear, or did you want to know more?
I just wanted to state what the difference was.
Okay, I think I haven't stated it too well, but I was kind of hoping the slides would do that for me.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program. There's time for only one last question out there. Something else people want to know about EcoVillage?
Do you find there's much barter between a lot of the EcoVillages taking place right now?
I wish there were. It's a great idea. The best I know is that in a group of communities which are not EcoVillages, which are income-sharing communes, which are part of this organization called the Federation of Egalitarian Communities, East Wind, Acorn, Twin Oaks, Dancing Rabbit, and some others, they share labor. Labor goes from one community, people come from one community to the other to help each other. For example, people come from all of those communities to the annual sorghum festival to help harvest and cook sorghum at Sandhill Farm in Missouri. I think eco-villages will get connected with each other and with transition towns, but I think that we haven't seen much of that yet. Thank you.
Our thanks to Diana Leaf Christian, Eco-Village News publisher and author of Finding Community and Creating Life Together, for her comments here today. We also thank our audiences here as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 105th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.